5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the new Panic Room. It's the show other shows want to be, and the show that authors want to be on.
The all-new Panic Room radio show is brought to you by HellboundBooks.com.
Well, 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 good evening. It is the new Panic Room, episode 283 on the 28th of July, 2022, almost the end of the month, and then it'll be August, and yeah, it's... my daughter, bless her, goes back to school sort of 10th, I think it is. So bless her, summer holidays coming to an end. So she's all sort of depressed and, you know, you kind of get used to having the little sods around. So it's going to be, the house is going to be all too quiet with without her. So back to naked writing days for me, which is liberating in many ways, if somewhat, you know, it's an upsetting mental image for most people. But speaking of upsetting mental images... Well, yee-haw, good evening, Eric Steiner. How are you this fine evening?
I'm good. I get up a little earlier now, so I'm kind of like you. At this time of night, I'm like, oh, my gosh, it's so late, which is weird because usually I'm just now catching my second wind, so I feel like I'm getting old.
Yeah.
Okay,
hey, join the club.
Yeah.
I mean, I was awake at 5 this morning. I managed to snooze until I was awake for a bit, and then I managed to snooze until sort of 10 to 6. So,
no,
sorry, 10 to 7. Sorry, so I had a really big light in, you know. But yeah, I'm usually tucked up in bed now and asleep by half past 10. Because it's, I know, but yeah, when you've been up since, 6 o'clock, unusual time, that's a bloody long day. And I'm up and at my computer working trying to get a big project finished, and it's one of those things, it's like the universe knows, I'm working to a tight deadline, which I know I've already missed it before I even start. I'm supposed to have it back Monday, and I'm just projecting forward. No fucking chance, because my phone decided to pack in, so I had to deal with that. I had to, it just was cutting out. And so I was on the online thing to Apple support, and some numpty in fucking Calcutta saying, well, oh, just update the operating system. It'll be fine. So I did that because that did no good. So I took it to like Best Buy, which is like the approved thing because it's closer. Did all the tests. Mm-hmm. So no, nothing wrong with it. Got it home, and it died a fucking death. I took it to Apple, and he plugged his nice fucking dead. And of course, guess which numpty thought it was a good idea to cancel the AppleCare. I'd had it like 3 or 4 months. So I can save $9 a month.
Oh no,
$9 a month. And of course, it's out of warranty, so I've had to bite the bullet and buy a new fucking phone. I mean, luckily, I've not, because I usually sell my phones, but my old iPhone 8, I thought nobody's got an iPhone 8. So luckily, I managed to dig that out. The battery life is like 20 minutes, pretty much, but if I keep it plugged in, at least I can, because everything else I can do on my computer, but obviously text and phone calls. I need my phone, and it's just and running backwards and forwards to Best Buy, then back to that to got the mall and got the because that's eating up a bunch of time. I thought, right, okay, today that's done. I've got my new phone's not due till tomorrow, so I'll spend all day. And of course, then wannabe business partner sort of on the phone, and that was 3 hours gone, two hour and a half stints gone, which is great, all good stuff, but. I'm thinking, further behind, but then again, it's if it's a couple of days late, what are they going to do, really?
Right.
Off me and give it to somebody else to do. they might get a bit upset, but a couple of days is not going to fucking kill it, to be honest with you. So, but it's me, I'm because I think it's from my early days in sales, I'm very target driven, very target driven, very deadline driven, and it kills me if I have a deadline, if I miss it, it kills me. Sometimes you have to take a deep breath, think it's not that important, that I'm still going to get paid. They might be a little bit sniffy because I've missed it by a couple of days, but it's not the end of the world.
I think it's even interesting when, within Hellbound, if we set a target date and, it's not on target and you're like, we set a deadline. I'm thinking,
I'm terrible. I'm terrible with you. And with anybody who works for us, it's like, I expect deadlines to be, because it does, it eats away at my soul to miss a deadline.
Oh, gosh.
Especially because I sometimes I will give myself a deliberate deadline. I will promise a client, I will have it done by X, because that motivates me to get off my arse and do it. But I never ever factor in the interruption factor. Like I say, the interruption today was all good stuff, brilliant stuff, you know, great. You know, it's nice occasions to step outside of the writer and that and talk your business, which was brilliant.
Yeah.
Enjoyed that. But, yeah, so I just need to learn, because I'm starting to think, oh, well, if I do some work over the weekend, no, I'm not. Because it's my last weekend with my daughter, because she's at her mother's next week. So last weekend of her summer vacation with my daughter. And I need the weekends. I need to take that breather, you know. I think you told me that. That's from you.
Yes. Yeah,
you made me do that.
And
it's good. Mm-hmm. No, exactly. You know, I need to have that. Plus, there's stuff to do about the house. I mean, before I bought the house, it wasn't because I had nothing really to do. You know, I couldn't afford to go out anywhere. It was at a rental house, so really wasn't nothing to do. But now there's stuff to do. I'm enjoying it. Funny, I enjoy cutting my own lawn. It's an absolute pleasure for me to go out and cut my lawn. I've swapped out my security lights. It is all horrible, boring domestic stuff, but I'm loving it. I really am loving it.
Yes, that sounds great. You know, you mentioned back to school and, you know, we're just seeing the commercials for back to school and stuff. And this is the first year that I don't have to worry about that. I mean,
of course.
And I'm sad.
Oh, I'm so sad.
I know. I don't know what to do with myself. I suppose I could go out and buy some school supplies for child in need.
Do you know, you could go buy supplies and just donate them to the school if you want. That would be a nice thing to do,
feel like I don't know what to do. I mean, it's so weird that, you know, oh my gosh, because you know that rush, the back to school, oh gosh, we have to go shopping, we have to do this and do that, and there's so much to do, and it's almost like a rush, and now I'm like, I got nothing. I'll miss that, and it's...
Well, if you want, you can come over, you can take my daughter to school, and I just bought her a bunch of, she needs to look, you know, spectacular for going back to school, so I just bought a bunch of back to school. Everything's black because she's going through a goth phase. Everything is black and, you know, skulls on it and what have you. But she will look fabulous. But But anywho, you know, we can natural fight about domestic rubbish. But I'm excited for tonight's show. It's going to be a doozy. So do tell us what we've got coming up.
Yeah, I'm super duper excited, and both of our guests tonight, I believe it's what group that there's a Facebook group that talks about horror. You know, what's your favorite? You know, the best scary book, and I keep seeing both of these titles like everywhere, and I'm like, I have got to get these guys on, and I asked the authors, and they said yes, and I'm like, wow, that's amazing. That's how that works, huh? So our first guest tonight. I know. Our first guest tonight, we have Jennifer McMahon, and I've seen her book, The Winter People, like everywhere. Mm-hmm. She'll be talking about a new book, but I've seen her stuff everywhere, and I'm so excited to talk to her. And then later on in the show, we'll have Jason Rakulik, and again, his book has been like everywhere over Facebook recently, and I read it, and so it's excited to talk to him too. So it's gonna be an amazing night.
Brilliant!
Yay!
Brilliant! Okay, I think we need to let our first guest out of the green room.
All right, our first guest of the evening, we have Jennifer McMahon.
Hello.
Ooh, yay. Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you for joining us. We're absolutely thrilled to bits to have you on the show. How are you this evening?
Well, I am thrilled to be here. I was really enjoying listening to your stories about working from home and the distractions and interruptions, and boy, do I know about all that. I can relate.
Oh, yeah. I think it's one of those things, and you know, when we are, you're the same, you know, when we do set deadlines for ourselves, we never build that in. we never think, oh, like, you know, my phone could break. I've got to run to the mall. That's 2.5 hours gone, you know. And you just don't build. And we should. We should always build in the Murphy's Law factor.
Yeah, build in, like,
definitely,
a little cushion, because something's going to go wrong. Yeah, absolutely. And then for me, I know when the writing isn't going well, if I'm, like, stuck, and you know those days where you're kind of trudging along and you're not kind of in the flow?
Yeah.
And I'll find excuses. I'm like, oh, the fridge is making a funny noise. I better go check that out.
Yeah.
And when was the last time I scrubbed the grout behind the toilet? That's when I know, I'm in true trouble with my work if I'm choosing to go scrub grout.
I'm with you. Yeah, I'll just decide. Yeah, I think we all have our thing. You know, sometimes I'll go, oh, you know, I'm sort of, like you say, you know, sat there and I'm slogging away on a scene or whatever, and think, oh, do I need to buy spaghetti this week? You know,
yeah.
Go from the desk and go in the middle of a scene, middle of a bit of dialogue, and go and check the pantry to see if I need to buy spaghetti. Like, you know, at the end of the week, like.
I do the cooking in our house, so I will, like, plan an elaborate meal and have to go out and get all the ingredients and then cook. The distractions.
I think, you know, I always thought it was me. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I and the kids love their pasta, so yeah, it's a given, just buy spaghetti, whatever.
Exactly.
I think procrastination is... It's a disease of being a writer. I mean, we all suffer from it. I thought it was just me, but getting involved in writing and all the rest of it with groups and that, it's not. We're all just as bad as each other, which is kind of comforting. It's like it's part of the job, the fact that, oh, suddenly I've got to go clean the cat litter out, and I'm there, and I'm halfway, and then I realize I don't even have a cat, but I'm on my way. I'm going to go clean the litter out, damn it. Make a mental note by a cat. Then again, another ex. I mean, it's funny because I have dogs, and everyone listens to the show knows I literally live with a pack of dogs. And of course, they want to go out, and that's a nice break. That's a break for me, letting the dogs out.
Five minutes later,
letting them back in, and then 10 minutes later, letting them out. You know how that goes, you know. But for me, it's probably the one thing, you know, when I'm really in the zone, it's probably the one thing that's preventing me from dying of deep vein thrombosis is letting the dogs out every 20 minutes.
Yeah, have to get up.
And social media has just made it 10 times worse, I think, because so many distractions. And I have known authors that they just unplug totally and they just write on a, you know, like a... You know what? I don't remember what those things are called. Yeah.
Yes. Parchment.
And it's awful.
Mm-hmm.
It is terrible. I see those.
Yeah.
I see that notification.
I turn off my Wi-Fi sometimes. Yeah.
Yes.
It's distracting.
That's
right. You're absolutely right.
Well, the problem is...
I'll turn it off. I'll just unplug and tell myself I'm going to write for 2 hours, and I cannot get back online. I will not have any distractions.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, once upon a time when I was leaving the house all the time, we have a Chinese restaurant here in town, and it was the one place in town that I could not get online. I could not get Wi-Fi no matter what I did.
Nice.
Oh,
so
brilliant.
I would go
yeah.
and it was never crowded. The food wasn't great, but I went and I would go and I would order food and I would get cup after cup of tea and I would tip really well and I would sit and I would get so much done because there were no distractions. No one I knew came in to talk to me. It was great.
Oh, that's great. I mean, the problem for me is, I mean, I used to work on my a very, very old laptop that couldn't get online if you begged it. It was just too old. But it was great. I mean, I had Word on it, and that was about the only thing. But it was, and that finally gave up the ghost. Again, another one of those things about a couple of months ago. So I've got this new one. But the thing is, I mean, when I'm working, you know, sometimes you need to research things or look up names. You know, think, oh, I'm going to think of a character, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I was doing it on the phone, and I found squinting at my bloody phone. This is ridiculous. So, because I've got this new laptop now, which can manage to get online, and of course, so I can use it for, oh, I need to look up this, I need to look up that, whatever. But of course, you know, I'm looking up something for what I'm working on, and then, oh, I'll just check my Facebook while I'm on here. Oh, I wonder what's happening on my email. And suddenly, 20 minutes, half an hour's gone. And it is the biggest time waste of... And my cell phone is... it broke, actually. But my cell phone, very peachy. Because at the end of every day, it'll come up with screen hours of the day. And it's like, shut up. Seriously, who asked you? Who asked you? I've increased my screen time this week by 8%. Well, fuck off, seriously. Who the hell are you to chastise me?
It's your phone. I would turn that off, yeah.
Your fault, phone, it really is. I'm glad it's broken now. It serves it bloody right. You honest? Yeah.
Well, Jennifer is here to talk to us about her book, The Children on the Hill. So tell us a little bit about it, Jennifer.
Sure. It's my 11th novel. When I set out to write it, I wanted to write a book sort of exploring the themes of monsters and monstrousness, and what it means to be a monster, and what monstrousness really is. And part of the story is set in 1978 on the grounds of a small psychiatric hospital, the Hillside Inn, and it follows the story of the narrator, 13-year-old Violet, who's being raised by her grandmother, who is the psychiatrist and the director of this hospital, the inn. And she's living there on the grounds of the hospital, and she's living there with her younger brother Eric, and they have kind of an idyllic childhood. They're living with their grandmother, they're homeschooled, they have free reign of the woods. They're monster obsessed. They have a monster club. They're writing a book about monsters. They go out on monster hunts. They go to the drive-in to see monster movies, and things are going well. And then one day, their grandmother brings home a girl from the hospital, from the inn. And this girl shows up, and she's scarred, and she doesn't speak, and she's showing obvious signs of trauma. She doesn't seem to even know her own name or where she came from. And Vi kind of makes it her mission to figure out who this girl is and what her story is and where she came from. And in the process of this, she comes to see that things at the inn aren't quite what they seem, and maybe her grandmother isn't quite what she seems, and she begins to wonder if this girl, who her grandmother has instructed for her to treat her like a sister, if she might actually be a monster of some sort. So that's kind of where I started with it, and I'm not a plotter or planner or outliner. I just kind of dive in and go, and that was my dive-in point, meeting Vi and wondering what was going to happen next, because that's why I write. I write to find out what's going to happen next.
I love that answer, especially I'm not a planner at anything, actually. So when something actually comes together, I'm like, "Wow, would you look at that?" I really admire somebody who can go in and plan everything out, but I sure cannot do it. And I think that oftentimes, even when you do try to plot something out, if your characters kind of take over, it becomes of their story, and you're just writing it. I know it sounds really odd, I think, especially to people who aren't writers, but I think that definitely they just take over and do what they want, and so sometimes we're just as surprised as the reader is.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree. I feel like I have to just kind of give the characters the space and the breathing room they need to do their own thing and let them tell me their story, you know? And and it's fun. And my third novel, way back years ago, my editor actually asked for a really detailed outline, and that was the only time I tried to write a really long, detailed outline. It took me more time to do this damn outline than I would have probably to do a rough draft of a novel, because I kept doing a draft, and it was terrible, and I'd hand it in, and they'd say, no, this needs to be tweaked, and this needs to be tweaked, and I worked on this outline for months. It was ridiculous. And finally, I got to the point where everyone was happy. My agent was happy. My editor was happy. Everyone was happy. And I sat down to write the book, and I felt so boxed in and bored, and I hated it. I hated knowing what was going to happen and trying to follow this silly little outline, so I threw it on the floor. I just threw it away. I was like, nope, and I just dove in, and I did my own thing, and I let the characters show me the way, and I turned in the book and my editor said, well, this wasn't in the outline and this wasn't in the outline. I said, and I said, I know, and isn't it a better story? And she said, yes. So that was the last time I attempted
good for
to
you.
I am glad
that. I admire people who do it, and there are people who do it and do it really well, and it works for them. And they don't have, like, I spend a ton of time doing rewrites and revisions because my first drafts are a hot mess. I mean, they make no sense at all. They are sprawling. They're all over the place. I would be deeply ashamed and embarrassed if anyone, an actual other person, took a look at them. It's a process. It's a lot of revising and revising and whipping things into shape. And people who outline don't have to do that as much. So I'm kind of envious of that. But I don't know. I feel like it takes the fun away.
Yeah, I find I have to have a plan, even if I then deviate from it. But if I don't, I just meander off. Off I go,
okay.
Off at a tangent, which is great and it's fun, but nothing to do with the book, nothing. But is what I need that part to come back to, even if it's only so I know I'm deviating. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Once the characters come to life, it starts. A number of times, my ending is completely different, but at least I got there within. You know, it's not taking me 600,000 words to get there because I kept wandering off somewhere, you know. I wrote one, but that's actually a bit of a favourite, my second novel, which is the Erotic Odyssey of Colton Forshay. That's the only one I wrote without any sort of plan. I just started from...
Mm-hmm.
You know, the opening line actually came to me in a dream because that's our life now. That just grew organically, and I managed to get to the end without it being, 600 pages long. So, but after that, no, it was hard. It was hard to keep coming back to the story, and I learned my lesson that one the hard way. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you always know how things are going to end? Does it ever change, or do you stick to the ending that you had in mind?
It can change. I can have something firmly in mind, and by the time it's evolved and I get to that point, that the ending I had in mind just wouldn't make sense. It wouldn't fit.
Yep.
So that does happen.
Yeah. No, I never know where I'm going. I never know how things are going to end, and when I think I know... I'm usually wrong.
There you go. So it's just a problem. I mean, the thing is, if it keeps you entertained while you're writing it, then it's great. Because the minute you're just like, the minute we get bored, as a writer, the minute we get bored, that's it. It's dead. It's just I have two, maybe three novels. I'm about nearly halfway through, and I just got bored. Towards the middle, and just thought, well. That's it. My brain will just flatly refuse. But no, I'm not finishing that. Do something else. But we always fool ourselves by, we'll come back to it. We'll work on something else. Mm-hmm. We'll come back to this one. And I've got books that it's probably been, 10, 11 years. I'm not going back to them.
Yeah.
I've pulled like ideas and characters from things that I've put away before to weave them into a new story, but
mm-hmm.
So I never throw anything away. I save everything because you never know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we're great at recycling. Yeah, I'm with you. I've scenes, characters, even some subplots, whatever, have popped up elsewhere because that's they fit. It's funny. It's a strange life we have. It really is.
It is. Yes. Yes,
well,
indeed.
I want to hear more about the Children on the Hill. I think we have a clip to play. Do you need to set it up? Yeah. Do you need to set it up, Jennifer, or do we just jump right into it?
I'm not. I think you can just jump right into it. Yeah, just jump right into it.
Right. Okay, so here we go. We're going to jump now.
...and swore to never speak of what we'd done as we pulled on our pajamas and crawled into our beds, still human girls. Can you guess what I am? I ask the girl now. I don't mean to. The words just come shooting out like sparks popping up from a fire. Ah, she says, looking at me all strange. I don't know. A ghost? Someone who was once a human being? And that's just how she says it. Bean. Like we're all just baked beans in a pot. Or maybe bright multicolored jelly beans, each a different flavor. I'd be licorice. The black ones that get left at the bottom of the bag. The ones no one can stand the taste of. I shift from one foot to the other, bits of my disguise clanking, rattling, the hair from the tangled wig I wear falling into my eyes. I love this girl so much right now. All that she is, all that I will never be, all that I can never have. And mostly, what I love is knowing what's coming next, knowing that I will change her as I've changed so many others. I am going to save this girl. When do I get my wish? She asks now. Soon, I say, smiling. I am a giver of wishes, a miracle worker. I can give this girl what she most desires, but she isn't even aware of her own desires. I can't wait to show her. So, do you want to play a game or something? She asks. Yes, I say, practically shouting. Yes, oh yes, oh yes. This is my favorite question, my favorite thing. I know games. I play them well. Truth or dare? She asks. If you wish. But I have to warn you. I'll know if you're lying. She shrugs. Tugs at her triple-pierced right earlobe, squints at me through all her layers of black goth makeup. A good girl, trying so hard to look bad. Nah, let's play tag, she says, and this surprises me. She seems too old for such games. My house is safety. You're it. Already running, she slaps my arm so hard. It stings. I laugh. I can't help it. It's nerves. It's the thrill. There's no way this girl with her stick-thin legs and cigarette smoke-choked lungs can outrun me. I am strong. I am fast. I have trained my whole life for these moments. I'm running, running, running. Chasing this beautiful girl in the black hoodie, her blonde hair with bright purple tips flying out behind her like a flag from a country no one's ever heard of. A girl so full of possibility, and she doesn't even know it. She's running, she's squealing, thinking she's going to make it back to safety, back to the bright lights of her little cabin that are just now coming into view through the trees. Only bright because of the low hum of the generator out back. No power lines way out here. Thinking she's actually going to make it home, back to her parents, whom she hates, and her warm bed with the flannel sheets. Back to her old dog, Dusty, who growls whenever he catches my scent. He knows what I am. I have weeds woven into my hair. I am covered in a dress of bones, sticks, cattail stalks, old fishing line and bobbers. I am my own wind chime, rattling as I run. I smell like the lake, like rot and ruin and damp forgotten things. I can easily overtake this girl, but I let her stay ahead. I let her hold on to the fantasy of returning to her old life.
I didn't want that to end. Oh, my God.
Wow. That was great. beautifully read as well. It was all sort of atmospheric.
No.
Yeah, the narrator, a woman named Erin Moon, did a fantastic job with it. I was just so thrilled when I heard what she was. Yeah, it was great, and she was very hands on in the process while she was recording. She kept texting me to ask opinions on how different characters should sound and ask what I thought was happening in different scenes and the mood that she wanted to convey. And it was great.
Fantastic. No, it was great.
From the introduction from like the point of view of the monster in the book. And the monster point of view I kind of added in a little later in the process of writing the book. But I had a lot of fun doing it. It was really fun.
I like that. My last novel, Tenebrin, which was a demon thing. And again, it was done, and I thought, there's something missing. Brilliant story, love it to bits. And I thought, hang on. And I then slotted in bits from the demon's point of view, from the other side.
Oh, that's great.
It's peering at the real world, or the our world, through cracks, you know, in the I guess the fabric of whatever it is, and it's peering out, and its whole objective is to get out, and it just brought it to life. It added that. And I remember it was a technique I first came across when I read early James Herbert. Big, big fan of James Herbert, bless him. And he did that with the rats, you know, and he would suddenly would slip into, and it would be in italics, and he would slip into the point of view of the rats. And it was like, that was brilliant. So I evoked that, and you're right. I mean, it does. It just adds that extra dimension, you know. Suddenly your monster or your demon or your giant rat or whatever is not just a mechanism for the horror. It becomes a character. Mm-hmm. And I think we actually published a book a long, long time ago called The Walls Don't Talk, They Scream by Dahl. And that it was from chunks of it was from the house's point of view. The house was evil, it was haunted, whatever.
House's
point of view. And that was
I love that.
What a great book. One of our early ones, and we must be 5 or 6 years old now, but brilliant. Mm-hmm. Again, I like that. I like that bit of different, and you know, to dare to do it from the point of view of the monster, I think is brilliant.
Yeah. When I'm working on a book, it almost feels like doing a bit of a collage. So I like to work in different time frames and different points of view and different, like this book has, I've got my 1978 with Violet's point of view, and then I've got the present day where we meet a character who is a professional monster hunter named Lizzie Shelley. And then interspersed with that, I had a lot of fun doing excerpts from the Book of Monsters that the children wrote in the 1970s. So I put actual chunks of the Book of Monsters in there, and then I had I made up a true crime book about what actually happened at the end. So I put excerpts from that in there. And I kind of wove it all together, and then I have a few points of view from the monster. And
it's
really fun. It was a lot to keep track of, you know, just trying to get it all together in a way that makes sense. And for me, the way that I always do that is so I write my really messy, sprawling, crazy first draft, and then I print it, and then I lay it on the floor, chapter by chapter and scene by scene, all over the floor of my house. And then I really do treat it like a giant collage, and I start moving things around, and I color code, and I'm like, okay, this is from the monster point of view. I've got way too much monster here. I need to pull back on that, and I need to hear more from Vi here, and oh, there's a scene missing here. I better write something for that, and only when it's laid out on the floor like that and I start kind of picking it up and treating it like a puzzle almost, does it start to really make sense to me, and do I get what the book is really about? I need that bird's eye view, you know?
Definitely want to read this book. So when you go to make out the signed copy, that's XTINA.
Oh, dear. Do you know, shameless.
I am. I just love. I love to be scared, and especially, you know, we got a saint, you know, psychiatric. It, to me, there's nothing scarier, to be honest. But Man, that's
agreed.
Amazing. Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah, I think there's a lot of me in this book. You know, I grew up in the 70s, raised by my psychiatrist grandmother, and I grew up monster obsessed, and I loved all things monster. I loved all those old monster movies. You know, the classic Universal Studio monster movies like Dracula and Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. And I loved all that stuff. And I just, I loved it. And I actually was so monster obsessed that at one point I got a book on werewolves, and I found a spell in it for how to become a werewolf. And I seriously went out on a full moon into the woods and did the spell to try to turn myself into a werewolf. Because I thought
how did that go for you?
Well, you know, it was profoundly disappointing.
Oh, well,
because I ended up, you know, I did the spell and I went back home and ended up just having to go back into my normal life and crawl into my normal bed and wake up in the morning and eat my normal stupid Cheerios and go to school and deal with all the normal girl things, and it was very disappointing.
Well, boo.
Very disappointing.
You know, it's funny, I always wanted to be a werewolf too. I even now I would love to be a werewolf. I mean, vampires are fine and all that, but I mean werewolves, they're proper. Vampires are a bit,
I always wanted to be a vampire, so I
didn't
want to
be a vampire.
Yeah,
I did.
A sparkly one. Stina wanted to be a sparkly one.
No, but I didn't. I don't want to be one of those really scary, ugly ones. I did kind of want to be the cool, like, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you know, those kind of vampires. Star from The Lost Boys. Oh, I was obsessed with her. So.
I remember The Lost Boys. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's good. Yeah.
I remember watching The Howling. Went to see The Howling at the movies. I was from about 15, I think, when it went 15, 16 when that came, when we went to that. And I think for me, a lot of the appeal was getting to run naked around the woodlands, which apparently you can't do if you're not a werewolf. So there's a life lesson. Life lesson for everybody out there listening. Don't do that.
No.
I hate to do this, but I think we are just about out of time for our first segment. You have to promise to come back and see us. Then I wait awkwardly.
Absolutely. I would love to. I would absolutely love to. I would be honored.
Great. We'll do a whole show next time, because I definitely think we could keep talking for a while now. This has been amazing. And tell us real quick where we can find you online.
You can find me at my website. It's www.jennifer-mcmahon.com, and there's links there to Facebook and Instagram.
Awesome. And for all of our listeners out there, go out and buy The Children on the Hill by Jennifer McMahon. And again, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you both. It was so much fun. Thank you. It was well worth staying up past my bedtime.
You
get yourself off pretty bad. Okay, have a great one.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, time flies when you're having lots of fun with wonderful people. But it is time to crack open a new bottle of Chardonnay for you. Sorry, and by bottle, I mean box. time for me to go and do my usual. So we will be right back after these messages.
Panic Room Radio Show is brought to you by Hellbound Books Publishing, purveyors of all manner of dark fiction. You can find the publisher, along with links to all of their available works across platforms, at hellboundbookspublishing.com. In the mood for something steamy to read? Check out erotica author Jennifer Lynn at jenniferlynnerotica.com. You can find James and Xtina at their respective websites, jameslongmore.com for James and darkpoetprincess.com for Xtina. Don't forget to follow The Panic Room on social media. Facebook, Unofficial The Panic Room Radio Show. Our Vimeo channel with all of our previous shows. The new Panic Room Radio Show. And come visit us at our website, www.panicroomradio.com.
Welcome back. We are back. Hopefully, Xtina's back.
She's back. Yay.
She's back. Hello. Could you actually say that any more sort of, you know, sort
Woo!
Of pathetic? I was just thinking there while I was having the wee. You know, speaking to Jennifer, though, it's funny. I mean, I have said this before. You know, it took me a lot of years to realize that not everybody's brain worked the same way as mine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great that now, you know, mixing with writers and even you know, poets, you know. you know, and poets and proper writers, obviously. learning about different processes. I love just that mental image of Jennifer there, surrounded by you know, just paper. You know, I never print anything out. I'm happy with everything. You know, on a computer, which is kind of surreal when you think it doesn't physically exist. It's just ones and zeros in a computer. You know, but everybody, we all have our own little, our own processes and our own little quirks and all the rest of it. It's nice that we can discuss those in a safe environment. I mean, again, you know, if Jennifer was in, you know, in a business, you know, worked in an office or whatever, and she said, well, what do I'm doing a process and I print it all out and put it in, they put her away, you know, and
yes.
You know, like we said, you know, I'm halfway, you know, I'm writing a report for the board of directors, but I need to get up and go and check the pantry just because I just have to. And that, again, you'd be fired, on the spot, but yet it's an acceptable way. I read a great article. Well, to be fair, it was an article about procrastination. I was going to read it. I might read it next week. I don't know. But no, great article about procrastination. That I mean, it's built into, it's hardwired. It's human nature. And I think those of us who write, for some reason, we battle against it probably more than most. More than most.
I don't know.
And it's to do with basically your brain just doesn't want to do it for some reason. And yet it's funny. You know, I will put off and put off and put off. And then when I finally, I've run out of other things to do, and I sit my ass down and write. And literally a few minutes in, it starts flowing. I'm loving it. I'm thinking, why do I fight this? Why?
Yep.
Why can't I just harness this feeling? Get up tomorrow morning and go,
sickness.
Right, straight into that. No, I have to go through the same bullshit every day. Got to do it all, don't you? And it's almost like a great, great tip I picked up from a Chuck Palahniuk blog. And I did it. He said, buy yourself a big hourglass, yeah? And I bought one. It cost me a bloody fortune. And it's an hour's worth of sand. But turn it upside down. Don't move from your seat. Don't do anything until the sand is all at the bottom. So, you know, worst case scenario, you've had an hour's worth of writing. Best case scenario, which usually happens to me, unless I'm on a struggling day, is you just carry it, you forget, and suddenly a couple of hours are gone, and the sand is at the bin at the bottom, and blah, 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 blah. I would recommend it.
I like that.
Because it's treating your brain like an errant four-year-old, you know, right? You've got to sit there and finish that.
Pretty accurate. Yeah.
Don't move till you finish that. And that's exactly what we're doing. But it worked for me. So if you're struggling out there in writerland, give it a try. You know, so what happens next? I don't know.
You say that every week, but you remember. You know what time it is.
Yeah, but I don't. No, I just lose track of shit. You know, man. I only know it's Thursday because it's the show. To be honest with you. And if you didn't remind me, I would forget. Exactly. If you didn't bug me, I'd be in bed asleep now, and you'd be wondering where the hell I was. So.
That'd be sad. Yeah. You have
You'd
a button to push there. Yeah, I would. I do. Yeah. So.
That's what we do. Okay, here we go.
Oh, hey. Looks like it's time to review something. Oh, no.
Hey, everybody.
Oh, no. Hey, Samantha. How are you, my dear?
Hey. I'm good. We're getting ready, you know, to go back to school here soon.
Oh, you as well,
You know, I'm going to go cry. I'm going to go cry. I don't have that this year.
I was going to say, I'm going to go cry, but not for the same reasons you are.
I'm going to be happy having to get up at, you know, get up at whatever time of clock to get my daughter to school. So it's going to affect all of us in different ways, but it's still going to affect her. It's come round. I mean, normally she goes back sort of the end of August, but it's actually the 10th this year. I don't know why.
Yeah, that's really early.
She still had 10 weeks, so I guess they maybe started early. The thing is, the past couple of years, I mean, with COVID and whatnot, she got used to having, like, you know, 13, 14 summer vacations. So I think it's a strict, it's only 10 weeks. I'd like a couple of days off, 10 bloody weeks, to be honest, but it doesn't happen. Grown up is terrible. We just want to grow, can't wait to grow up, and then we grow up and it's like, well, this is awful. It really is awful.
It is. But we have to get up at like 6 o'clock here, and then we fight my little girl, you know, for an hour before school to do all of, you know, things that 7-year-olds have to do. And then by the time you get to the car, I've forgotten 12 things. I'm cussing like a sailor. The whole neighborhood probably thinks that I'm like the worst mom in the world. I mean, it's like so stressful trying to get up, get everything ready, make sure you have everything.
Yeah,
and even though we try to do it like the night before, it still doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. Nothing works.
So
it never does. You always forget something.
Something. Yeah. And I'm notorious for getting to the damn school and letting her get inside, and then I'm like, oh, fuck, I forgot her medicine. Or, oh, great, I forgot her snack. Got to go all the way home, come back, you know, because if you don't send that snack, total meltdown at 1 o'clock.
That's where we're different, if I forgot it. So shit. I mean, my daughter's a little bit older, and if we forget something, that it's on her. It's on her.
I literally live like 3 blocks from the school, I feel bad. It's like mom guilt. I'm just sitting here like, well, damn, I could have taken it to her because she's going to bitch me out, you know, after school if I don't take it to her.
I'm not as sad anymore that I'm not going to deal with this year.
No, hey,
you can
start your day drinking a lot earlier this year. So, silver lining.
So, Samantha, what do you have for us this week?
Okay, so I finally hopped on, the Black Farm bandwagon.
Oh.
Guys, I have to paint this picture for you because it's so fucked up. I get this book because my friend can't read it. It's got a lot of child death in it. She lost a baby recently, so she can't read it. She gives it to me. I'm all excited. And then I realize as I'm about to open this book that I have a friend that I talk to here and there. We're not like as close as we used to be, but I know her. And she messages me just to let me know as I'm opening the book to start it that her mom killed herself that night. So then I'm like, oh, God, do I even want to start this? Because this book is about, like, suicide. So I'm like, okay, we're just going to push through because maybe it'll make me feel the story more. This book is so fucked up. So you basically have Nick and Jess. They're a married couple. Their child has died. So they kill themselves. They can't live with it anymore. They're very heartbroken. Wow. And they believe there's no afterlife. So when they kill themselves, they very much believe that there's going to be, like, blackness and silence and nothing. And then that's not what happens. They wake up in this place called the Black Farm, and it's where all of the suicidals go. So if you've killed yourself, this is where you go. Only suicidals go here, and it's ran by this person called the Pig. And this world is so fucked up. You just die over and over again, like terribly and horribly, and you just keep waking up here, and there's not supposed to be any escape, and it's like super hopeless. And, the whole book is a trigger warning for so many things. And you've got really just fucked up characters. Like, the Pig, he's just weird. He's so fucked up. And he's got, like, it's kind of like they gave him free reign of this afterlife. And he's like a Dr. Mingle. He just does what he wants to who he wants. And Nick is determined to find Jess because they wake up without each other. And so the whole book is like him trying to find her, and, he's just being maliciously tortured. And then there's a sequel, which I'm excited and both leery to read this because of how the first one ended. But, this book is really, like, it's a mind fuck. Like, the whole time I was reading this, I was just thinking about, like, my friend's mom, you know, and it's like, oh, God, does an afterlife like this really exist? I certainly hope not, because it was very dreary, and there's just no hope until, like, the last 30 pages.
Wow. I give you credit for following through, for reading till the end. Yeah.
No, it's a really good book, and I feel like I felt the story deeper. Well, and I'm one of those people that have always wondered, like, what really happens when we die? Is it just blackness? You know, is there something else?
Yeah.
Where do we go? And it's so fucking scary to think, like, people that, you know, are suicidal or any other, like, anybody could just wake up in this place where they're just tortured over and over again, and it's separate from hell. Like, in the book, they're explaining, like, it's separate, you know, it's not really the same thing. Everybody gets tortured, you know, like, in the black farm and hell, but it's, like, it's a different type of torture. And so, like, for, like, the last week, I've walked, I've walked around, and it's like, damn, like, what happened? Like, this is, I don't know. Like, I just, it makes me even more, like, leery of wanting to do anything to get me hurt or get me, you know what I mean? We don't need to know anytime soon.
Right. No, wow. I have definitely seen this book often.
God, it's everywhere.
On Amazon,
it's everywhere.
And then the groups. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yes.
So what would you give it? What rating would you give it out of
I gave it a total 5-star. I mean, it
wow.
is such a mind fuck. And the sequel was called Return to the Black Farm. It's by Elias Withrow. I mean, I really think everybody should read it, especially people that question, like, the afterlife, or if they've ever, like, I don't know. Like, I feel like if you struggled with suicide, it would be a good book to read, just because it's one of those, like, it would make you think.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a
mm-hmm.
lot of talking in the book, you know, like, you didn't think about other people, or how you know what I mean? It's kind of like a hint to...
Right.
This isn't the answer kind of deal.
Right.
Which I felt like that was an important message, because I've always felt like that's just a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And I think it's addressed well, especially when you get to, like, the end. It's a really good book. I think everybody should really read it. But it has a lot of trigger warnings. So, you know, you might want to, like, look those up first.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Samantha. And, again, give a little plug to what the book was and who it's by.
The first one is called The Black Farm, and then the sequel is called Return to the Black Farm, and it's by Elias Withrow.
Awesome.
Brilliant. Sounds great. Fantastic.
Yeah, thank you.
I need
and,
to read that.
Wait.
It sounds right up my street.
I can't wait to see what you have for us next week. thank you.
Yes,
thank
I will
you
see you all
bye-bye.
Then.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Right, okay. I think we have our second guest of the evening waiting in the green room.
Yeah.
So I do your business.
All righty, our second guest of the evening, we have Jason Rakulik.
Hello.
I'm hoping I didn't butcher that.
Hi there.
Did I butcher your last name?
Hey, Jason.
No, you pronounced it perfectly. That was exactly.
Yay.
That's exactly how we say it.
Normally she butchers. If it's not Smith, she butchers it pretty much. Even then, you know, she's had a moment.
So, and may I say, I love the music on your show. Is there a playlist somewhere where I could, like, it sounds like a bar that would be really fun to just get up here.
No, you know, it's basically music what I like.
I know, but do you have a list somewhere? Like, you
no.
should have a soundtrack on the website, because I really would love to listen to more of it.
That is a great idea. Maybe we should.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should look into that. It's pretty eclectic. I mean, you know, it's really what takes my fancy. So, I'll put that in mind, yeah.
There's often we get done with a show or even during it, and I'm messaging James, what is this, you know, what song is this? And so tomorrow that's all day long, that's what I'll play, is one of the songs that he mentioned. So,
I'm gonna go back and look up. I listened to the last episode, and then I was listening along to this episode, and the music is just it's just so much fun. I want to listen to, like, an hour of it.
we could arrange that. Yeah, we could. It might be a fun idea, actually. We could put that on the put a playlist out. That'd be great. I like the idea. Thank you. We should look at that.
Sure.
Definitely.
So, So I just finished Hidden Pictures a couple of days ago. Jason was is on to talk about Hidden Pictures. And, tell us a little bit about it before I start asking your questions.
Sure. Well, so Hidden Pictures is a story of a babysitter, a nanny, rather, named Mallory Quinn. It's kind of got a turn-of-the-screw sort of set up, but imagine a very contemporary turn-of-the-screw. She's hired as a live-in nanny to watch a five-year-old boy named Teddy. She's left her home in sort of blue-collar South Philadelphia, and she's gone out to this very bucolic, very affluent suburb. And Teddy is 5 years old. He loves to draw. And the most unique thing about the book conceptually is that every time Teddy shows Mallory one of his drawings, we see it too. It's just reproduced full page mm-hmm. in the book mm-hmm. in its entirety. And at first, they're normal five-year-old kid drawings, like, you know, birds and a bird bath and trees. But then
his drawings
start to turn sinister. He shows her pictures of, like, a man dragging a body through a forest or digging a grave. And she starts to become concerned. She's like, well, you know, these aren't normal things for a kid to draw. They're things that no child really should have access to, you know, like mentally mm-hmm. he just shouldn't be aware of, like, things like murder or grave digging. And
right.
so the parents sort of dismiss it. They say he has, like, a rich imagination and, you know, he's been reading a lot of Grimm's fairy tales. But she is convinced that he is you know, she can hear him in his bedroom. He has an imaginary friend. They're having conversations. And she begins to suspect that he's channeling something. And these pictures keep turning up. They start to get more and more sophisticated. Like, his drawing is getting, you know, better or way beyond the ability of a five-year-old. And she begins to think that something or someone is telling a story through this child. And she begins to think that maybe if she put these pictures in the right order, she could figure out a sort of mystery. And you, the reader, since you're seeing everything when she sees it in real time, you're sort of invited to play along and figure it out with her. And I tried to make it, even though, you know, there's a big supernatural element in the book, you know, it's clear pretty early on this property is haunted by something. I did want it to be, at the same time, a fair play mystery with plenty of visual clues.
Yes.
And, you know, no cheats.
I loved it. And I have to say the twist at the end there, I did not see that coming at all. So, you know, when you say you're invited to play along and there's clues, I'm thinking there were. I'm going to have to go back now. And see what these clues were, but no, and I think that there might have been a few there, but I didn't get it. I didn't. I just okay, and I loved it. I did. I don't even know if I can say it. You know, the good things, because I'm a very picky. Not I don't know if picky, but kind of like, you know, red balloon, and I just wander off. I'm very. It's hard to get me to sit down and concentrate, and I did with this book. I couldn't wait to, you know, get done with it, whatever I was doing, so I could read more. I just the writing was just great, and the characters. I loved all the characters. I loved Adrian and. Yeah, when everything started to go bad for Mallory, I was like, no, please. And then I'm looking at how many pages I have left, and I'm like, I really need a happily ever after. And then I hit a part where I was like, well, damn, I don't think I'm going to get one. And I was all over the place, yes. But I thoroughly enjoyed myself, though, I will say.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, I was excited to the twist, though, and that I do have, you know what, I don't know if, I try not to give anything away if anybody wants to read it, but we did have a question. It was actually from our reviewer, and she wanted to know, because of the ending, did the book have any hidden political agenda?
No, not at all. I think I know what you're alluding to, but in my mind, it's really hard to talk about it without giving away spoilers.
Right.
I think this book is about something that's actually pretty common if you know the sort of crime that actually happens in the book.
Right.
Oh, I mean, I'd love to talk to you about it. If we're willing to give spoilers, I could talk at length about it. But I don't think there are any political overtones to the book because
I personally didn't either. Me and Samantha, we saw it on a somebody made a post about it on Facebook, and that's what the discussion was. And I was like, really? I didn't see it either. So.
I will tell you, I mean, you know, one of the interesting things about this book, and I don't know if this speaks to, like, the moment we're living in right now, but, you know, thankfully, you know, there's lots of lovely reviews on Amazon, but if you go into my one-star reviews on Amazon, I have been called anti-religious, I've been called anti-atheist, I've been called a racist bigot, I've been called a liberal snowflake, people say I'm anti-pit bulls, anti-dog. You know, and they're never going to read me again, and they will never support this author in the future. And so I don't know what to make of that, really. Like, I'm still kind of trying to process it, but I feel like, well, I think this is what it means to be an author in 2022. I'm just trying to write honestly about the kind of people I meet in the world every day. I'm a parent. I know a lot of the parents in my neighborhood. I live in, like, a pretty liberal neighborhood, but I also know people who are, like, you know, libertarians with, and, you know, you know, with maybe, I know some elderly people with antiquated views about race, you know, as we all do.
Right.
We all know those people.
And, you know, it's, they're just characters in the story. They don't what I believe personally.
Just imagine if that's all we could write about was, you know, the character like yourself. So, you know, everybody in your story is a male. You know, I mean, that would just limit you. So I just, I did not personally think there was anything political going on. But that's why I had asked, because I'm like, man, maybe I missed, you know, so much here, but I just thought it was a great story, a great mystery, and I love the fact that I did not see the twist coming. I just did not see it. And I could gush some more, but I think we have a clip to play. I love this book. I did, so I'm kind of excited to hear the narrator and stuff. So I don't know if you need to set up the clip or we just can go into it.
I can set it up. I think the clip you're going to play, it's from the very beginning of the book. It's almost like a preface. And all you really need to know is that our narrator, Mallory, she's sort of in a bad place in this scene. She's kind of addicted to OxyContin painkillers. And she goes to get money, quickly. She agrees to sign up for a medical experiment at the University of Pennsylvania. She doesn't know what it is. And she gets into this room, and they explain to her all they're going to do is they're going to put a blindfold on her. She's going to stand in front of these five guys who are, like, medical students. And she has to raise her hand when she feels them looking at her. They're going to look at her body. She's going to be blindfolded. But if she feels the male gaze, she should raise her hand and lower it if she doesn't feel it. And I think that's what you're about to hear.
All right.
Okay, I need to press a button now, don't I?
You do.
I do. Here we go.
The male gaze on my person. She told me to keep my hand suspended for as long as the feeling lasted and lower it whenever the feeling went away. We'll do it for 5 minutes, but after we finished, we might want you to repeat the experiment. Do you have any questions before we start? I started laughing. Yeah, have you guys read 50 Shades of Grey? Because I'm pretty sure this is chapter 12. This was my attempt at a little light humor, and Susan smiled to be polite, but none of the guys were paying attention. They were futzing with their clipboards and synchronizing their stopwatches. The mood in the classroom was all business. Susan fitted the mask over my eyes, then adjusted the strap so it wasn't too tight. All right, Mallory, does that feel okay? Sure. And you're ready to begin? Yes. Then we'll start on my count of three. Gentlemen, get your watches ready. That's one, two. It's very weird, standing still for 5 minutes, blindfolded, in a perfectly silent room, knowing that guys might be looking at your boobs or your butt or whatever. There were no sounds or clues to help me guess what was happening, but I definitely felt them watching. I raised and lowered my hand several times, and the 5 minutes seemed to last an hour. After we finished, Susan asked me to repeat the experiment, and we did it all over again. Then she asked me to repeat the experiment a third time. And when she finally pulled off the blindfold, all the guys stood up and started clapping, like I'd just won an Academy Award. Susan explained that they'd been performing the experiment all week on hundreds of women, but I was the first person to deliver a near-perfect score, to report the gaze three times with 97% accuracy. She told the guys to take a break and then ushered me into her office and started asking questions, namely, how did I know the men were staring at me? And I didn't have the words to explain. I just knew. It was like a fluttery feeling on the periphery of my attention, kind of spidey sense. I bet there's a good chance you felt it yourself, that you know exactly what I'm talking about. Plus, there's a kind of sound. Her eyes went wide. Really? You hear something? Sometimes. It's very high-pitched, like when a mosquito buzzes too close to your ear. She reached for her laptop so fast she nearly dropped it. She typed a bunch of notes, then asked if I'd be willing to come back in a week for more tests. I said for $20 an hour, I would come back as much as she wanted. I gave her my cell phone number, and she promised to call me to set up an appointment. But that very night, I traded my iPhone for 5 Oxy 80s, so she had no way of tracking me down. And I never heard from her again. Now that I'm clean, I have a million regrets, and trading away my iPhone is the least of them. But sometimes I'll remember the experiment and I'll start to wonder. I've tried to find the doctor online, but obviously I don't even remember her name. One morning, I took the bus to the University Medical Center and tried to find the auditorium, but the campus is all different now. There are a bunch of new buildings and everything's scrambled. I've tried Googling phrases like gaze detection and gaze perception, but every result says these aren't real phenomena. There's no evidence that anyone has eyes in the back of their head. And I guess I've resigned myself to the fact that the experiment didn't actually happen, that it's one of the many false memories I acquired while abusing oxycodone, heroin, and other drugs. My sponsor, Russell, says false memories are common among addicts. He says an addict's brain will remember happy fantasies so we can avoid dwelling on real memories, all the shameful things we did to get high, all the shitty ways we hurt good people who loved us. Just listen to the details of your story, Russell points out. You arrive on the campus of a prestigious Ivy League university. You're strung out on kickers and no one cares. You enter a room full of handsome young doctors. Then they stare at your body for 15 minutes and erupt in a standing ovation. I mean, come on, Quinn. You don't have to be Sigmund Freud to figure this out. And he's right, obviously. One of the hardest things about recovery is coming to terms with the fact that...
These clips are never long enough. They're never long enough. You know, we need it to be like the whole book, I think, would be good.
She's a great narrator, too. And, you know, I do always want – you gave Mallory such a great voice. I mean, it wasn't – I always wonder when it's a, you know, it's a male author writing a female. I wonder, you know, do they do them justice? Sometimes I try to go, I wonder if this – you know, especially when it's a female writing in the mind of a guy. There's so many times I'm like, guys don't sound like that. There's no way, you know, and it just takes me right out of the story. But I mean, you wrote Mallory so well. I really, you know, so I mean, I'm just wondering what was your inspiration for the, you know, your characters, for especially for this story?
Well, I mean, the main inspiration was the idea of just I wanted to do something unusual with the form of the book. I mean, I wanted to try to do a book. I feel like, you know, you know, right now we do so much reading on screens, and I see people on subways looking at their phones, and you know, the text on their screens is bracketed by all kinds of graphics and animations and pictures and colors. And I was just thinking about, you know, ways to sort of blur the lines between like a book and a movie, and, you know, bring in elements like graphic novels and things like that. So that was really the impetus for it. I just didn't know what the story was going to be, but I knew that I wanted there to be illustrations, and I knew the two people I wanted to do them, and they were like, they were friends of mine, and they were so talented. I was like, well, whatever I want them to do, they can do it, you know? And then I suppose, I mean, I've always loved suspense, horror, thrillers, supernatural stuff, you know, all that stuff. And so, you know, after about 3 months of just kicking around different ideas, I wanted the pictures to be organic to the story. I didn't want them to be decorative. I wanted a character. I wanted there to be an artist in the story creating pictures. And you know, there was a practical element of this too, because I needed a lot of pictures, because I wanted there to be a lot of pictures in the book. And so, it helped that these were a five-year-old's drawings and not like oil paintings.
Right.
Like, you know, getting 50 or 60 oil paintings, you know, I was never going to find anyone crazy enough to do that. But these drawings, you know, could be dashed off pretty quickly, although they're a lot more challenging than they probably look, to get, like, to make them look authentically like they're actually created by a child. I think they probably ended up doing 300 illustrations for the 50,
wow,
50 or 60 that ended up in the book. We had a lot of outtakes.
It definitely created a different layer to the book that I really enjoyed. And I think I did spend longer looking at the pictures, just wondering if are there clues in here that I should see that I'm not seeing. And so that was definitely fun.
Well, and I heard your earlier interview. I didn't hear all of it, but I heard part of it. I was listening to the interview with Jennifer where you were talking about outlining and how, you know, outlining versus not outlining. And this was a book where, because of just the nature of it, because everything was a clue pointing toward a big twist where,
yes,
you know, knowing the ending from the beginning was critical, you know, because I think if I didn't know where it was going, I don't know what I would be writing. You know what I mean? Like every picture in this book is pointing toward the last 50 pages.
Yes.
So, I mean, there are even illustrations that I think take on a second meaning after you finish the book. If you went back and read it again, you'd be like, oh, that's why Teddy's drawing rabbits. That's why he's always drawing.
Yes.
You
yes,
know,
definitely.
That's why there's a goat in this book. You know, things like that. So, so for this book, at least, I think, you know, an outline was imperative, although I do know why that's not right for every book.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like so much discipline to know exactly how you're going to end it and then, you know, start writing it and end there. Because there's so many. James, you know, is the same, and he's basically a red balloon, and he'd go chasing it this way. And so, that's amazing.
Squirrels.
Squirrels.
I see squirrel and I'm off, you know.
Sure.
I hate to do this. I think we are out of time. And, oh, my gosh, I could have spent an hour on each one of my authors tonight. So you have to promise to come back. I mean, I did get your name right. So, yay! Awesome. So let us know real quick where we can find you online.
Oh, you know, with a last name like Rakulik, I'm really easy to find. If you just type my name into Google, I'm the only one. Like, you have no trouble finding me. I'm on Instagram, it's my name, Jason Rakulik, and that's my website, too. Surprisingly, it was not taken, so.
All right, for all of our listeners out there, go out and buy Hidden Pictures by Jason Rakulik. And I can't wait to have you back. Thank you so much. Yay!
Yeah, all right, please. Post
have
a
great
post
rest of your
evening,
Jason.
To the music.
Yeah, there's a great tune about to come up, so stay on the line for that. Okay, bye-bye.
Oh, okay, I will. Thank you.
Bye. Well, it is, you know, I don't know where the time's gone tonight. It's just, yeah. So, unfortunately, it is
great.
Time to say goodnight, Xtina.
Goodnight, Xtina.
Goodnight.
Here's my story, it's sad but true. It's about a girl that I once knew. She took my love, then ran around with every single guy in town.
Hey, hey, whoa. Away from a run around to a whoa.